ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இந்த நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இந்த நிகழ்ச்சியில் பங்கு பெறும் அனைத்து தியான மைய அன்பர்களுக்கும் இதர அன்பர்களுக்கும் எங்கள் வரவேற்பையும் மகிழ்ச்சியையும் தெரிவித்துக் கொள்கிறோம். இந்த பகவான் சித்திரத்த தினம் இன்றைய நன்னாளில் மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப் எம்எஸ்எஸ் பாண்டி அவர்களின் லைஃப் டிவைன் ஸ்பீச் அமைந்திருப்பது மிகவும் மகிழ்ச்சியான ஒரு நிகழ்ச்சி. இந்த நிகழ்ச்சிகள் பின்வருமாறு: 5:30 to 6:55 ஸ்பீச் பை மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப். அதற்கு பிறகு 7 to 7:30 வரை தியானம். அன்பர்கள் அமைதி காட்டி நிகழ்ச்சியில் பங்கு பெறுமாறு தாழ்மையுடன் வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறோம்.
Okay. Good evening. Today we're going to start the first of a series of talks on Life Divine, starting with the first chapter. So many, Life Divine has been described in so many ways by so many people. But recently, Appa came with a new description, which I felt really captured the wisdom of Life Divine in a very new way. He says, Life Divine is the horoscope of the universe. Life Divine is the horoscope of the universe. It gives the whole story. The whole past and the whole future. If a young child asked you, Mommy, Daddy, tell me the most wonderful story imaginable, the most fantastic fairy tale, the happiest possible story with the most wonderful ending of all, with all our imagination, with all our capacity for wishful thinking and fantasy, we could not tell a story that is so wondrous, so marvelous, as the story he tells in Life Divine. We are not capable of imagining anything more wonderful than the story he tells. But this is not a story. He tells us this is the reality. This is the truth. The story he tells in Life Divine is the story of the universe, the story of our lives, the story of humanity, and the story of our future. And there is no possible story that could be more wonderful than this. There is no ending, there is no ending, but there is no goal that can be more wonderful than this. There's no answer to the meaning of life that can be more wonderful than the one he gives us. He divides the book into his story into two books, Book One and Book Two. Book One, he calls, one second, Appa is calling. Grace Flower has come for our meeting from Appa just now. He starts in Book One, he calls it the omnipresent reality and the universe. Omnipresent reality is not something that we know, not something we can easily understand. What is this omnipresent reality? He's to explain to us in chapter 4 what the omnipresent reality is. And it's a conception that goes beyond the highest conception in any spiritual tradition. It includes all that is there in the spiritual tradition, but it goes beyond. In a word, he says it's the infinite, the absolute. But that explains very little to us at this point. In book one, he's going to tell us how the omnipresent reality became the universe. He's going to explain to us what the omnipresent reality is in all its aspects, stage by stage. And he's going to explain to us how that omnipresent reality has become the universe. He calls book two, The Knowledge and the Ignorance, Spiritual Evolution. It's a long title for book two, The Knowledge and the Ignorance, Spiritual Evolution. The knowledge is what we know of spiritual truth. The ignorance is the world as we know it. The spiritual evolution is the process by which the ignorance becomes the knowledge. And he divides book two into two parts. The first part he calls the infinite consciousness and the ignorance. The infinite consciousness is that omnipresent reality that he mentions in book one. The infinite consciousness is the divine. And he tells us in the first part how the infinite consciousness has become the ignorant. It's one of the greatest mysteries of spirituality, which Sri Aurobindo alone has explained. God is all, if God has created everything, if all is Brahman, then what is the world? And how has it been created? And why is it the way it is? He tells us in very great detail the process by which the infinite consciousness has become the ignorance. And how it is evolving. The spirit is evolving in the ignorance. And then in the second part, which he calls the knowledge and spiritual evolution, which means it's the evolution of this ignorance back to knowledge through spiritual evolution. And he tells us the destiny, the process of the spirit evolving back from ignorance to knowledge, and the destiny of the universe, the plan, the purpose for which the divine has become the universe in the first place. And in the last chapter, which is the divine life, he reveals the ultimate goal of this whole wonderful fairy tale, which is for God to manifest itself fully in life in the universe. In summation, if anyone asks you, what is this book about? You can say, it's the story of how God became the universe, and the universe is evolving back to become God, or to manifest God. So in sum, the omnipresent reality became the universe of ignorance so that the spirit could evolve in matter, life, and mind to manifest the divine in form, to manifest the formless infinite in finite form. And this origin of things will evolve out of that ignorance, first as knowledge and finally as spirit, which he calls spiritual evolution. Man's origin is God. Man aspires to become God. That is evolution. But he has to follow the methods of nature. And those are the methods and the process he describes in this book. Whenever we read a chapter in Life Divine or any thought in Life Divine, if we want to get the full value of it, we have to look beyond and relate each idea with the other ideas that he presents. And the most important central idea of life divine is that the whole life is a marvel. It's a play. It's a divine play of the divine creatively expressing itself in the universe for the delight of that creation, for the joy of an adventure, an eternal adventure of the divine in space and time. Chapter 1 is called The Human Aspiration. Now, if you were going to start a fairy tale to tell your child, a marvelous fairy tale that should exceed the most wonderful story ever imaginable, how would you start? What would you say first? Probably, if you were like me, you would start with an ordinary person or an ordinary situation beginning on an ordinary adventure. You would begin a story slowly and gradually build up. And eventually, at the end of the story, your hero or your heroine would discover the marvel of what the universe really is. But that's not the way Sri Aurobindo tells this story. He tells us the end of the story right at the very beginning. Because no matter how many times he tells us the ending, it will never lose its marvel. Each time we hear it, we have to be reminded over and over again until finally see the vision. We understand this is not a story at all. This is our story. This is true. So he starts off in the very first page by talking about the infinite. He starts by telling us that our ultimate, most wonderful, most unimaginable dream is true. Our highest aspiration is true, and it will inevitably become reality in life. He tells us in the beginning without any suspense. And what is the message he tells us in a single sentence? That the destiny, our destiny is, though we are human beings in an animal body, our destiny is to become divine beings in a physical body on earth. And that it's inevitable. He says that humanity's most ancient aspirations will inevitably be realized because they are the intention of God. They are the intention of nature. What we want is what God wants in us. What we aspire for is what God aspires for in us. That is the purpose of the to manifest God in life on earth, to make life divine. Our highest aspirations are bound to be fulfilled because it is God who aspires in us and sanctions our most marvelous dreams. Life is not a dream. The world is not an illusion. They are real, and they are intended for a divine purpose. The universe is the form and body of God, because it's God has become the universe. This God is not a jealous God sitting up above on some throne who demands our worship and our obedience and punishes us. This is a God who's infinite. He's infinite being, infinite consciousness, infinite bliss. Sri Aurobindo says, why do you want to worship God when your destiny is to become God? The individual, he says, is the transcendent divine. We are that. And he tells us the divine plan. There is a plan, a very detailed, meticulous plan, which he lays out in this book. He says that everything happens according to the will of the divine for a greater purpose. Everything is as it should be, as it needs to be. Everything works for our progress. Nothing is wasted. There is no waste in nature. Nothing is meaningless. Even our ignorance, our stumbling, our errors are part of the divine plan. He tells us in a few chapters later that error is the hidden truth. Error is the meaning. Talked about the long key and the secret. The aspiration that has to be fulfilled. The human aspiration that our aspirations are for the tools. The system is the enemy of our progress. We have nothing to overcome but the skepticism that refuses to believe what our real destiny is. For the last few years, Appa has been writing so much about Pride and Prejudice, and in Pride and Prejudice we see this truth. Everyone's highest aspirations are fulfilled. Mrs. Bennet aspires for the marriage of her daughters, and her aspiration is so powerful that it brings Darcy and Bingley and Wickham to Meryton. Charlotte and Collins aspire, and they get what they want. Jane and Bingley aspire, and they get what they want. Wickham, he wants to become Darcy's brother-in-law, and he does become Darcy's brother-in-law. Mr. Bennet hides in his library. He wants his daughters to be married. He gets three daughters married without any expense at all. Elizabeth aspires for romantic love. She wants to marry for love. She gets an unimaginable accomplishment. And Darcy accomplishes against all odds. He accomplishes against greatest opposition what appears to be almost impossible. So he starts off this chapter by telling us that the highest aspiration of humanity is destined to be fulfilled. He starts with a sentence, the earliest preoccupation of man in his awakened thought and his inevitable and ultimate preoccupation is the highest which his thought can envisage. It survives the longest periods of skepticism and returns after every banishment. Our highest aspiration, he says, is the divination of Godhead, that sense that there really is a God that exists and we want to meet it, we want to reach that divine, the impulse towards perfection, the search for pure truth and unmixed bliss. This is the aspiration that's been there from the most ancient of times, and it survives all periods, it survives all banishment, it survives all skepticism. Today we live in a world in which, because of science and technology, we have analyzed the externalities of nature. We have mastered so much, created so many comforts and conveniences, that it looks like we have everything man could wish for, could ever wish for. But in truth, all these comforts and conveniences do not satisfy the human aspiration. We still perpetually yearn for something more. No matter how much we are satisfied, we can never give up that quest. It will always come back. And so he says, the earliest formula of wisdom promises to be the last. God, light, freedom, immortality. There is no higher wisdom than this. There is no higher goal than this. There is no higher aspiration than this. And it is this wisdom that is our destiny. We, even from the earliest times, man has known it. Man has aspired for it, and man has been right in seeking it. Light that we aspire for is the infinity of mind. The freedom that we aspire for is the infinity of the soul. The immortality that we aspire for is the immortality, the infinity of the body. The finite human being aspires for the infinite, and that is our destiny. Then he tells us what we all know when we, it's all very nice and inspiring to hear these grand ideas, these persistent ideals, but what of our normal experience? When we look in the world, when we look at life, we don't see light, freedom, immortality, joy. We see our normal experience contradicts this high aspiration. On all sides, we see people suffering around us. We see the ignorance around us. We know death is an inescapable reality. And he tells us that this contradiction between our highest aspiration and the reality that we see around us with our eyes and feel, perceive with our senses, this contradiction is actually nature's most profound method. To our common sense, what he calls to our material intellect, this contradiction between the highest ideal and the present reality is a proof that our ideals are simply dreams. It's wishful thinking. It's not something that we can ever realize. How can we become immortal when the smallest thing disturbs us? How can we become divine when we're filled with such human propensities, human attitudes, urges, impulses, sensations? He tells us this is nature's method. He tells us the secret of how our highest aspirations will be fulfilled, will fulfill themselves, by confronting the very opposite condition. Where common sense tells us that the opposite condition must mean that our aspiration is a dream, he tells us the opposition to our aspiration is the proof that it's going to be realized. He says that nature fulfills its intention by creating conditions which appear to be the very opposite of what it wants to achieve. Appears, notice the word, appears to be. What are those contradictions? Well, there's the contradiction between God and nature, God and the world. God is something invisible, something unimaginable, something out of reach. Nature is all around us, compelling us to act the way we do. They seem to be totally different. There's the opposition between the finite and the infinite. We feel so limited on all sides. Our capacities are limited, our knowledge is limited, our lives are limited. And yet we're told that the divine is infinite. What could be a greater contrast than the finite small person and the infinite divine being? There's the contradiction. We're told that the divine is eternal. And yet we're all so conscious of the fact that we live in time and every moment counts and every moment over is gone and our lives are short enough and they have an end coming. How can there be any possible coming together between this time and that eternity? And we have the contradiction between ourselves as a limited individual and the divine as a transcendent being. Sri Aurobindo tells us there's a super conscience, a huge spiritual world above us. And we know there's a dark subconscious, deep world below us. How can these contradictions ever be reconciled? And then he tells us of the ultimate contradiction, the contradiction between pure spirit and pure matter. Two things that are so opposite, that are so different from one another, that we can never, never imagine them ever being reconciled. And without reconciling spirit and matter, he says no divine life is possible on earth. These are the contradictions face us in what we are and what we know and what we imagine and aspire to be. That contradiction is between man, ourselves, and God. We say, man says, that God created man in his own image. We think that God created us kind of like a mini version of himself, but separate, without all his power, without all his knowledge, without his immortality, just as a separate person. But Sri Aurobindo says that it's man who has created God in his own image as a separate person. We are the ones who are mistaking and thinking that God is separate from us. It's not that God has made us separate. It's we have made God separate from us. That's our fundamental mistake. The truth is that God became us. God became man, and man is destined to become God. We are divided into so many parts. We have a physical part, a mental part, a vital part, a spiritual part. They have to become one by evolution. Man is God born on earth. Our origin is God. God is infinite. We are finite. But that finite, our finiteness is only an appearance. It's only what he calls a frontal appearance. In truth, we are that infinite. The finite and the infinite are inseparable, like fire and light. How can you separate fire and light from one another? They exist. They're two sides, two expressions of the same reality. We are the finite expression of that infinite. We do not exist other than by that infinite that is God. We are, because we are aware of our finiteness, we are unconscious. When we become aware of our infiniteness, we become conscious, we become divine. That is our destiny. And nature's task is to awaken us to the fact that we really are infinite, to make us conscious of what our real nature is. And all that nature brings to us, all the experiences that it brings to us, are to help awaken us to that consciousness of our true infinite being. And he says, This movement is irresistible. There is no turning back, there's no going back, and there's no stopping it. It doesn't matter what anyone says or anyone does. This is a story, it's already been written. The end is known even before the beginning, because God is driving the whole process. But we are faced with contradictions. Our aspiration is faced with contradictions. How are we going to resolve those contradictions? When we face those contradictions, the first thing that happens is we become skeptical. We begin to doubt. We don't believe. We refuse to believe. And he says, overcoming that skepticism, that doubt and disbelief is the way in which we open ourselves to the evolution. When we confront a contradiction, we say it's impossible. That's our typical, oh, it's just not possible. That's what Eliza says when she hears that Charlotte is engaged to Colin. Impossible. It's impossible, inconceivable. That's what Lady Catherine says when she comes to Longbourn and she says, people are saying that you are engaged to my nephew Darcy, but I know it's impossible. When Bingley falls in love with Jane, Darcy and Carolyn says, it's impossible. You cannot marry Jane. When Darcy proposes to Elizabeth at Hunstring, she says, it's impossible. I would never marry you. You're the last person on earth that I can ever marry. And after Lizzie meets Darcy at Pemberley, and she begins to really awaken to the possibility and want to marry him, she goes back to the inn and she gets Jane's letter and finds out that Lydia has eloped with Wickham. Darcy comes, he finds out, and then she realizes all is lost. Wickham can never be persuaded to marry Lydia, and she knows she'll never see Darcy again. It's impossible. All the characters in the story see the impossibility. And we know that all the things they said were impossible come true. And that's true for us. That's the truth of the universe. All the things that we feel are impossible today will become possible and will become reality in the future. Are we going to be like Lady Catherine, resisting and all the time resisting and saying it's impossible? Or are we going to be like Darcy, who says, I don't care if she thinks I'm the last man on earth. This is what I aspire for. This is what I'm going to get. And realize it. That's the question. So he tells us that contradictions are not the sign of something that's an impossible. It's the sign of God's intention. And the contradiction comes to release our energy, to release the energy of our aspiration, to make it a reality. That's the purpose of the contradiction, to challenge us. When Darcy proposes to Elizabeth, he's very aware of his importance, of his greatness, of his wealth, of his position. She's just the opposite of Darcy. She's the opposite of him in so many ways. She's lively, intelligent, individualistic. He's serious and arrogant and boorish. She's lively and cheerful. He never smiles. He never laughs. She's full of vitality. She wants a man who will love her, not just a respectable married life. He wants a woman he can love, and he discovers that light in the eyes of a woman who he said was just tolerable. And from very low connections, inferior connections, somebody he can never marry. That's the contradiction that comes to them that releases the energy. The distance between them releases the energy. That's what we have to understand. The greater the distance between where we are and what we want to achieve, the greater the energy and the greater the power that is released for the achievement. Therefore, let us not be reasonable and aspire for a little. Let us aspire for everything. Let us aspire for the most. In that way, we are most sincere to Mother. In that way, we are most sincere to our own true self, which is infinite. He says that these contradictions can be overcome either by a revolution or an evolution. These contradictions represent high achievements beyond the current level of what humanity has achieved. An individual can achieve it by a revolution. A yogi can achieve by his own individual effort. The society, humanity can achieve by a general evolutionary progression. We know in the story, there's a revolution going on in France. Thousands of aristocrats are losing their heads because the people in the lower, the common people in the society want greater privilege, want greater freedom, want to enjoy more in the society. English society doesn't like the idea of losing their heads, so they've decided there must be a more peaceful way to do this without revolution. English society wants to evolve. Revolution is necessary when the ego refuses its destiny, when it gets in the way. And we see Darcy. In the beginning, he's all ego. He's all pride and arrogance and self-importance. But he loves Elizabeth, and the ego gets in the way, and she abuses him right and left. She just smashes his ego. And that releases his energy for a revolutionary effort. He's like a yogi. He transforms himself. He sheds his arrogance, sheds his self-importance, sheds his selfishness. He becomes all that she can genuinely love and admire and be grateful to. And he becomes the revolutionary yogi who paves the way for the social evolution. Everyone else benefits from his spiritual effort. Jane and Bingley get married because of it. Wickham and Lydia get married because of it. Elizabeth is elevated to the highest level because of his effort. And he tells us in this chapter that the chief obstacle to our spiritual progress is what he calls the ordinary material intellect. What is this material intellect? It's that mind in us that takes the present reality as the limit of possibility. It's the physical mind which believes only what it sees. I'll believe it when I see it. When we say, I'll believe it when I see it, we can know that we are in the worst possible ignorance of the ignorant human consciousness, which he calls the material intellect. That's Elizabeth when she sees Darcy the first time. That's Darcy when he sees Elizabeth the first time. They see nothing but the surface. She sees a proud, arrogant aristocrat, and he sees a tolerable young girl. She sees the handsome, charming Wickham and takes that for reality and fails to see the reality of what she is. He is. She identifies with her mother. It's her physical past. She's blind to the opportunity because she looks through her senses. She sees only what her eyes tell her, just as he sees it. They both cling to the ignorance of the material intellect. So when we say something's impossible, what we really mean is we're looking at it through the material intellect. We announce that we're insisting on our ignorance, that we're insisting on saying, I will see, believe only what I can see. The material intellect is the principal obstacle to the divine plan. It's that which we have to give up. What is this material intellect? It's that which believes only what comes to us through the senses. how reliable is our material intellect? If you look back on your own life, how much did you predict? How well have you predicted everything that happened to you in advance? Did you predict 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and know where you would be today and all that would happen to you on the way? The material intellect never knows the future. But afterwards, when it comes to predicting what will happen tomorrow or what will happen next year, it insists on its own version of things. The material intellect is always blind. That's why Mother says the very first rule of psychic education is to give up our faith in the mind's externalized way of seeing things. That's the material intellect. Without that, we can make no progress. If we don't know, we can have faith. Faith is our foreknowledge. Faith is for the mind to accept the soul's intuition of what it doesn't know. To insist on what our material intellect knows is to insist on ignorance and to retard the whole progress that God and nature have in store for us. So the solution is not to try to convince the material intellect, it's to throw it out. Just throw it out. That's why she says the physical mind has to be rejected. Sri Aurobindo in the chapter says we need a deliberate reason. He's not asking us to be irrational. He's not asking us to discard common sense. He's asking us to look at the real facts, not facts of our senses. The real facts are we have never been able to anticipate the future, and the future has always brought marvels that were not there in the past. That requires a deliberate reason to understand what we are. He says the key is to shift. We have to shift from the outside to the inside, because the real answer for us is inside. We have to shift from the finite perspective of the material intellect to see the logic of the infinite that is expressing infinitely in our lives every day. We have to discover the infinite behind the finite, because the finite is only a frontal appearance. So he asks us to take a more deliberate view. Our viewpoint matters. That's what we must understand. If we want to fulfill our aspirations, the first thing we must do is take a more deliberate view that rejects the evidence of our senses and the limitations of the material intellect. First thing we must do is we must see that there's a problem. Only when we believe there's a problem, we can see there's a solution. Awareness of the problem enables us to convert it into an opportunity. When Collins proposes to Elizabeth, he refuses to recognize there's a problem. He refuses to recognize there's anything unacceptable about himself. And therefore, he goes away in a huff. But when Darcy proposes to Elizabeth, he recognizes the problem. He recognizes the problem is with himself. And he decides to acquire the knowledge from that and to make the progress that he should make. That awareness of the problem which he gets in Hunsford when she abuses him is the beginning of his path to glory. He tells us that the real goal of nature is divine life, and that the direct opposition between where we are and what the divine is nature's profoundest method and the seal of her completest sanction. The very fact that what we are seems to be so opposite to what we want to become, or what Sri Aurobindo says we are going to become, so opposite to God, light, freedom, and immortality, He says this is the surest sanction that we are destined to become that. Our aspirations are the very contradiction of what we know of life on earth. Therefore, we dream of a paradise in some heaven beyond. We think, let's go for moksha, let's get out of life on earth. He says, no, your real destiny is to make heaven on earth, to become God on earth. Now, we cannot even imagine that, so we think all, if anything great is there, it must be in the world beyond. He says, no, it's here on earth, in the body, in life, that we are destined to realize. We need not run away from life or abandon earth to fulfill our highest aspirations. The goal nature is striving for is the ultimate contradiction in of all. A divine life in an animal and egoistic consciousness. And that aspiration in us is the sign of a divine intention. So he starts the book with the human aspiration and he ends the book with the divine life. Then he tells us right in the second paragraph, what does he mean by a divine life? To know, possess, and be the divine being in an animal body. He's not talking about moksha here. His divine life means we will know ourselves to be divine, we will possess the divine, we will be the divine while we are in the physical body on earth. That's what he means. To convert our obscure physical mentality, that's the material intellect, into the plenary supramental illumination. We know how ignorant we are. We know we can't, we don't know what's going to happen a moment later. We don't know what's happening even a few yards away. We don't understand what happens. The plenary supramental illumination knows everything. That is our destiny, to know everything in space and everything in time, everything inside and everything outside, to have all the knowledge, the divine knowledge, to have the omniscience of the divine in an animal body is our destiny. To replace our transitory satisfactions, our pain, our suffering, with peace and self-existent bliss. Divine life means self-existent bliss. To establish infinite freedom in a world of mechanical necessity. We have no freedom. We have to sleep so many hours a night. We have to eat so many meals a day. We are limited in our movements. We're limited in our capacities. We're limited in our knowledge. How can we be free? We feel people, society imprisons us, it tells us what we can do and what we can't do. We're limited on all sides. He says our destiny is infinite freedom. And finally, the ultimate unimaginable contradiction, he says, the divine life will transform this mortal body that's subjected to death into immortal life in the body. The body that can live eternally, for as long as it wants, and can change at will. Nothing can be further from what we are today. Nothing can be more difficult to imagine. And yet that is the end of the story. That is our destiny. That is where we are headed. The goal of nature's evolution is nothing but in. And you can see this evolution in society. We know India that has become politically free 60 years ago. Now we see social equality coming. We see education coming for all. We see prosperity coming for more and more people. This is just the tiny little first step in the progress of evolution that will ultimately lead to divine life on earth. But what is the method? What is the method of realizing, converting this contradiction into a reality? He tells us in the next chapter. He tells us the method for transforming contradictions is to realize that the contradictions are actually complements. What we think is opposite, what we think is the obstacle, what we think makes things impossible, we must recognize this is the very condition we need for our progress. Think about Darcy. Darcy proposes to the woman he loves. She says, "You are a horrible, you're an abomination, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry." It looks to be the complete contradiction. He should give up. But he doesn't take that attitude. He says, "No, she hates me, but I love her. She thinks I'm abominable, but I will become what she wants." Her very abuse becomes the perfect conditions, necessary conditions for his progress. The scandal that the lies and falsehood and scandal that Wickham spread are a contradiction. They're a falsehood. They're not what Darcy really is. But that contradiction helps Darcy to become a better person, helps him to get what he wants. Even Wickham's falsehood, even his scandal, is a help, an aid in Darcy's progress. So we have to recognize whatever are the conditions in our life, however opposite they may be to what we want to realize, they are really the complements that we need for our progress. And the key for us is to learn the lessons from the contradictions and to find out how to reconcile them. And it tells us here that we reconcile them by harmony. He tells us that all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. Problems arise when we perceive a discord, an unsolved problem, and when we sense that there's a possibility for a solution, when we sense there's a unity behind that discord. That's what happens to Darcy. He loves Elizabeth. When he proposes to her, she rejects him totally. Yet something in him says, "No, I don't care what she says. I don't care even if she thinks I'm the last man on earth. Something in me belongs to her. Something in her belongs to me. I feel that unity deep within. I want to realize it." It's that sense in him. Whatever she says, it's not what I can hear. I know I must have her. That becomes the first step in his realization. Sri Aurobindo says, when we're faced with an unsolved problem or a discord, the practical mind in us, that material intellect, says, "Okay, we'll accept it. It's a reality. We'll keep quiet." We give up. We give up and we decide, let's be practical. Don't go after something very high. Let us accept the reality of what we have. We shut out the problem like Collins and refuse to acknowledge it. Or like Mr. Bennett, we go and hide in the library. "All right, I made a mistake. I married a foolish woman. Now I have to live with her. I will go and stay in the library and for the rest of my life." Or like Charlotte, we say, "I'm 27, I'm plain looking, I have no dowry, nobody's ever proposed to me, nobody's going to propose to me now." When Collins proposes to her, she says, "I'll never get another offer, I'll never get something better than this," so she accepts him. That's the practical intellect in us. He says it's the animal in us. The animal is practical. If you can get something now, I better take it, whatever it is. It doesn't believe in anything beyond. He says our progress comes when we accept the challenge, when we accept the contradiction and decide, "No, I will not compromise. Compromise is for the animal. I will not be satisfied. I will not take the easy way out. I will aspire for the highest that I can imagine, and I will keep working for it. Then he says, the greater the apparent discord, even if it appears to be an irreconcilable opposition, like Elizabeth says, you're the last man on earth. If anything's going to make a man give up, that should have been it. Aurobindo says, the greater the opposition, the stronger is the spur to reconciliation. The greater the opposition that we meet in life, the more the energy is released for our progress. How do we reconcile contradictions? We reconcile them by rising to a higher level of truth. Darcy did it. Elizabeth did it. They quarreled at Hunsford. She called him all names, and he abused her family and all. But they didn't stop there. He went back and wrote his letter. She went and read the letter, and she said, oh, it's not Darcy that it's his fault. It's my own family has ruined the prospects for Jane. It's not Darcy who has hurt Wickham. It's Wickham who has lied. I never knew myself. I'm so ashamed. I was so absurd. She recognized. She rose above her vital preference for the handsome Wickham, and she accepted the truth that Darcy has written to her. And what about Darcy? Instead of abusing her in his mind, instead of defending himself, what does that silly girl know? She believed that Wickham, who's a liar and a scoundrel. He didn't say that. He said, oh, she says I'm not a gentleman. She says I'm selfish and arrogant. Yes, there's a truth in it. I have to accept the higher truth in it. I must rise to the occasion. They both accepted the truth that came to them through the opposition. And they reconciled the contradiction by rising to a higher level and becoming better people than they were before. All the opposition that comes to us, all the contradictions that come to us to help us rise higher, to make us better than we are. No sense blaming other people. No sense saying that person is wrong and that person's harassing me and all. We must understand why the opposition comes. We must make the progress we should make, rise to a higher level, not convince that person to change. We must change so that we can realize at a higher level. That's what Darcy did. He reconciled the contradictions at a higher level. He transformed his pride and his self-importance into magnanimity and soft politeness. He shifted from his outer social personality based on money and status to his inner psychic personality, capable of real love and self-giving. He saves Lydia, that abominable girl, and saves the whole family from misfortune. He reverses his opposition to Bingley's marriage with Jane. So he says, when we take a more deliberate view, we see that the opposition that nature brings to us is really her sanction for our progress. And we discover her method is to use contradictions to help us progress. Today, humanity is faced with the opportunity for rapid economic growth all over the world. Countries like India and China especially. And yet, we're told by the scientists that if we continue to grow at this rate, we'll spoil the environment, we'll spoil our climate, and there'll be disaster. It's a contradiction. They say, we want development, but our development will spoil the earth. It appears to be a contradiction. We must know it's not a contradiction. It's nature's profoundest method telling us there's a better way. There's a higher way. We are not here as animals just to have more and more material goods. We're here to evolve spiritually. Nature is telling us that we should change our ways. The West may not know how to listen. It's for India to awaken and discover the message that nature is giving us. He says that all nature seeks a harmony. Problems arise to us because we are lacking that harmony. We have to find out how to restore the harmony at a higher level. Harmony is supermental truth. The truth is not our being separate people. The truth is the unity. He says the truth of existence is an incoercible unity. We feel separate from everybody. We feel everybody's against us. We feel everything is an obstacle to us. That shows that we are in the consciousness of ignorance. We have to rise to the consciousness that discovers the unity. The man who wants to produce and consume more and ignore the earth around him is in the ignorance. He must become conscious of the unity between us and our environment, between ourselves and earth. He says that nature has been overcoming obstacles all along, contradictions all along. The idea that we can overcome contradictions is not new. Nature has already overcome the contradiction between matter and life. Matter is inconscient. Matter is inanimate. And yet, in the mud and the stone, nature has created living things. Plants and animals that move, that sense, that are consciously aware, at least subconsciously aware. It's a contradiction. It's an ultimate contradiction. How can you make the stone move? How can you make the mud sense? How can you make it lean towards the sun or go drink for the water or make sound? Nature has already taken the contradiction of matter and life, put them together, and evolved a miracle, which we call life on Earth. And it didn't stop there. Animal life is subconscious. The animal is not aware of himself. The animal is not thinking. The animal is simply following his instinct. Our body is like that. It breathes. It doesn't ask us whether it should breathe. It doesn't think whether it should breathe. It breathes, the heart beats, the blood circulates, the hormones are active. Everything's going on automatically by itself. But in an animal body, nature has put conscious mind. That's us. We're thinking people. We're aware of ourselves. We're aware of the world around us. It's a complete contradiction. When I decide to go and walk across the room, my mind decides I'll go and walk across the room. But my legs are moving, my heart is beating, my blood is circulating. I'm not telling it what to do. It does it by itself. Nature has worked out this marvelous, astonishing reconciliation between subconscious life and conscious mind. It can inconscient matter. And subconscious life and conscious mind. So nature has already reconciled contradictions in an unimaginable way. If we knew nothing about world or life, and somebody, we came and saw millions of years ago a planet which was simply molten lava or mountains and on it, we could never imagine that planet could be of life. Like the moon today, it's completely barren. There's nothing on it. It's simply minerals. It's simply clay and dust, sand. We can never imagine how life can come there, how man could come there. But nature has already performed that miracle. So we need not doubt that contradictions are really complements. And he says the ultimate miracle would be an animal consciousness possessed of truth and light with the practical omnipotence resulting from perfect knowledge. That's the ultimate miracle. an animal consciousness possessed of truth and light, with practical omnipotence resulting from perfect knowledge. And that is the miracle that nature is creating in us. That is what we are. That is our destiny. That is our evolution. So he says the upward impulse of man towards higher goals, which seem to be opposite of what we are, is not only, it's rational. In fact, it's the only rational thing. It's irrational for us to think of being remaining animals like all the other animals. The only logical completion of the rule of nature is that we are destined to become something much greater than we are, just like the ape has become the human being, or the monkey has become the ape, or the fish has become the mammal. That is the very purpose of the universal striving. He tells us nature's universal striving, the purpose is evolution. And then he raises a question. Why should anything evolve? Why should life evolve out of matter? Why should mind evolve out of life? It's a mystery. If matter is really just inorganic sand and dust, how can life come out of it? If life is really the instinctive life of a plant or a lower animal, how can it start thinking and talking and acting in an organized, conscious way the way we do? He says, nothing can come out that is not already inside. That which is involved evolves. Life has come out of matter because matter already has a secret life in it. Mind is already there, buried in matter, because in reality, matter is only a finite frontal appearance for the infinite spirit. Everything is there, buried and concealed in matter, waiting to come out. Matter itself is Brahman. Matter is a finite appearance of Brahman, and Brahman is in the process of evolving out to reveal itself in its plenary splendor. It has already created life, it has already created humanity. And next, it must reveal itself as God. The Vedantic rishis knew this. They said that life is there involved in matter. They knew that mind is there, concealed in life. But they thought that the human existence was the end of the evolution. They thought now that man has come, now that mind has come in the animal body, the next step is that man should go for moksha. He should go back to the spirit. Because life, mortal life is so difficult. The body is perishable. The life is limited. Mind is ignorant. They never conceive that there's another step. But Sri Aurobindo says, we should not stop in the middle. There can be no objection if matter can become life and life become mind. Why can't mind become supermind? Why can't man become God? That, he says, is our destiny. Mind is there in the animal. He says the animal is the living laboratory in which nature has worked out man. And man is the thinking and living laboratory in whom and with whose conscious participation she wills to work out Superman, the God, that is to manifest God. Evolution is the manifestation of what nature secretly is. Man's impulse towards God, light, freedom and immortality, our aspiration, is really nature seeking to evolve beyond mind and discover what we really are in our inmost essence. Mrs. Bennet rose from the middle class to marry a gentleman. Her income, she rose wonderfully in life. But it doesn't end there. Elizabeth rises 10 times higher to marry Darcy at Pemberley. Wickham's father was served at Pemberley. He served there as a steward. Wickham's goal is he wants to keep rising. He wants to become Darcy's brother-in-law, a relative, and he does. Darcy has achieved wealth and status. He's not satisfied. He wants emotional happiness, psychological fulfillment, spiritual progress. It never stops. Don't stop in the middle. Whatever you have attained, don't stop. There is something much higher waiting for you. All that we have realized is very little compared to that. And then he tells us that this movement is inevitable. He says that the idea of a divine life is an eternal paradox. A paradox is something that's inherently impossible, apparently impossible. But he says, the eternal paradox is also the eternal truth. What looks to be impossible is really the truth. It's really our destiny. The aspiration of man to become divine or to have a divine or to realize the divine is a paradox. A paradox is a contradiction. But that is our destiny. We have an aspiration for mortality. We are in a mortal body. We aspire for immortality. It's a paradox. We're a limited individual consciousness. We aspire to be one with the divine infinite consciousness. We live in space and time. We aspire to discover the spaceless and timeless infinite. All of these higher truths can be realized in the lower terms. Our goal is not to give up what we are and become something else. Our goal is to bring that something else and realize it here, to become infinite in the finite, to become eternal in time, to become universal in the individual. He says, if we take a deliberate view, if we are willing to really be rational, we will see that our reason justifies this, and our deepest instinct of intuition confirms it. And then he speaks about that in us which resists, that in with us which evades. He says, all our evasions will eventually be defeated. There are so many attempts are made to persuade us to limit our mental activities, to be practical. How many times do parents tell children, be practical? How many times do we tell our spouse, be practical? Live in the immediate moment. Take the immediate as the reality. Sri Aurobindo says that these are the source of our resistance to the evolutionary movement. Man, we try to stifle the truth by saying be practical, by being skeptical, by refusing to even inquire, by refusing to even ask, is this possible? How is it possible? Is there a way? We enjoy the satiation of our present satisfaction and decide to be satisfied there, to level off here. We say, death is there. There's no way to overcome death, therefore we might as well give up and just enjoy ourselves now. The material intellect, the animal part in us, the physical mind, always comes up to tell us, be reasonable, be sensible, have common sense. Accept what you are and be satisfied. This is the main obstacle to our progress. The material intellect says, stop questioning, stop aspiring. It tells Jane, you better forget Bingley. Darcy, you better give up Elizabeth. Elizabeth, after Lydia's elopement, you common sense tells you you'll never see that man again. Give him up. This is the material intellect that we have to give up. What we call common sense is really organized ignorance. But he says, all of these resistances, all of these attempts to revolt against the secret will of the mother, of the great mother, will fail. Because the very paradox contains within it the energy for achievement. The violent opposition itself releases a vehement impulse, a violent hunger for a solution. We see it with Darcy. When Elizabeth abuses him right and left, says you're not a gentleman, you're selfish and mean, you're the last man, that violent abuse, instead of discouraging him, it releases in him a greater aspiration. That's how we should respond to the paradox. Not give up, not be reasonable in the normal sense, but take the challenge of the opposition as the energy for our progress. Sri Aurobindo says that when we accept the contradiction, it releases enormous power. And then we will see with the light of our reason that what we aspire for really can be achieved. I remember 30 years ago, Appa sent me to the Planning Commission. I met with a very senior person who had worked at World Bank and talked about the future prosperity of India. And he said, tell me really honestly, do you think India will ever be prosperous? That's the myth. He could not conceive of it. At least today, we don't talk that way. At least today, our senses tell us something is possible. That's the step in our progress. He says evolution cannot be stopped. Our earliest preoccupation inevitably will be fulfilled. Our ultimate preoccupation inevitably means will be fulfilled because it's infinity that's trying to express. It survives the longest periods of skepticism. It's an impulse towards perfection. It's a constant aspiration of humanity. It returns after every refusal. It's the earliest formula, which promises to be the last. It's the persistent ideal that's the contradiction of everything that we see in front of us in our normal experience. It's the unresolved discords that are matched with an instinct for unity, an instinct that tells us, no, no, I'm capable of something more than this. There's something more. The greater the disorder, the stronger is the spur to our progress. There's an unconquerable impulse in man because it is the divine's aspiration in man. It's an imperative impulse in nature. These are the words he uses to tell us, to inspire us, to awaken in us the hope, the longing, the aspiration that there in the depth of it is divine in us, to us. Our greatest, most wonderful aspirations are destined to be fulfilled. It's a cosmic necessity because it's the purpose of the cosmos. It's a persistent instinct and intuition of mankind. It's an unconquerable impulse. We cannot ask nature to stop. You cannot ask the poor to be content with their poverty as long as other people are enjoying prosperity. You cannot ask Mrs. Bennett to keep quiet as long as there's an unmarried daughter. She has an unmarried daughter and there's a rich unmarried man anywhere in sight of her. We cannot condemn higher aspirations because religion tells us to be modest or humble or don't be greedy or don't ask for more. The evolutionary impulse is irresistible. It's inevitable. It's the next step in our evolution beyond mind. It's the undying aspiration of the part. We are the part aspiring to become the whole. The divided parts of being trying to evolve back to become the whole. Matter and spirit, which are only two aspects, trying to become one because in essence they are one. They are one omnipresent reality. He says spirit is involved in matter. Apparent nature is secret God. Nature, having evolved man, seeks to evolve the spiritual man out of us, out of humanity. He invites, Sri Aurobindo invites us to join and lead the upward movement. That's what they came for, to call us to them, to join and lead that upward movement. The manifestation of the divine and the realization of God in man is the highest and most legitimate aim for man on earth. There's nothing greater, nothing more natural that we should seek than to seek the highest possible for us. He invites us to accept it. He invites us to follow it with faith until we acquire the knowledge. He offers us the knowledge, but we can start with faith. He invites us to shed the ego, to shed our selfishness, to shed our ignorance, to overcome the evil in human nature. He invites us to discover the divine in us and to let that divine out, to become one with humanity, to discover the soul in other people, to serve mother in all. And he assures us that no matter what we do as individuals, humanity will never stop aspiring until it reaches its ultimate resting place. And this is our destiny. So why should we wait? Why should we be following all the others? Why should we be the last? Why shouldn't we be the leaders that lead the way? This is the message of chapter one. And what an inspiring story. He doesn't talk about our weaknesses. He doesn't talk about our imperfections. He talks about our destiny, and he assures us our success is assured. Then why should we not rush ahead and embrace the adventure and the joy and discover the marvel that life is, the marvel that the divine has become, for the joy of that adventure? Why shouldn't we enjoy that adventure? The human aspiration will inevitably be achieved because the evolution is the irresistible movement of nature. Either we join it or we'll be discarded along the way. Nature's goal is divine life. Why shouldn't we rush to become more and more divine, less and less egoistic, selfish, ignorant, more and more universal, good, true, and perfect in what we are? Nature's method is to reconcile all the contradictions around us and convert them into complements. For us, it means not running away from the difficulties, not running away from the obstacles, not blaming other people for the troubling us, but for accepting every contradiction that presents itself as an opportunity and say, there's something I can learn from this. If a scoundrel like Wickham speaks lies about me, it has a lesson for me. There's something I should learn. I should make a progress, let alone Wickham. I should make a progress. He tells us that our view matters, our understanding matters. We should take a deliberate reason which rejects the common sense of the material intellect, which rejects the common sense that says, I will believe it when I see it, that has faith in our ultimate destiny, that knows the very fact of opposition is the sign for us is a message to us from the divine. This is possible. What we think is impossible is really inevitable. The more impossible it is, the more inevitable it is. So why should we turn away from it? Why should we try to be satisfied with compromises? We have plenty of time to compromise later. Let's rise to the challenge. In chapter one, he tells us that the goal is the reconciliation of matter and spirit. The ultimate contradiction. How can matter and spirit be reconciled? In chapter two, he's going to tell us that they can be reconciled in the cosmic consciousness. We can have an experience in which we see that matter and spirit are really not opposites at all. They're really not contradictions at all. They're two forms of energy, of one spiritual substance. In chapter three, he's going to tell us that matter and spirit can also be reconciled in the transcendental consciousness. In the infinite divine consciousness, we will see that both are divine. Both are forms of the divine in its manifestation. And in chapter four, omnipresent reality, he presents a new vision of what the divine really is, of what the infinity really is. An infinity that's not the opposite of the finite, an infinity that manifests in the finite. A transcendent that is not the opposite of the universe, a transcendent that's become the universe, a transcendent that's not the opposite of the individual, a transcendent that lives in each of us as an individual and is destined to manifest itself through us as an individual. He reconciles all the opposites and all the contradictions because they are all reconciled in that omnipresent reality. This is the starting point. This is the very beginning of his marvelous story. This is not the divine philosophy. This is not the divine explanation. This is divine life. He's talking about our lives. He's talking about what really we are. He's talking about what life is around us, what the people are around us, what the circumstances are around us. To understand his message is fine. But the goal is we must discover the truth of it in our own lives. That's why Appa has taken up Pride and Prejudice, so that we can see in a story the truth of all the principles of life divine can be illustrated in Pride and Prejudice. But better still, we should discover and see that all the truths of life divine can be discovered in our own lives, in every moment, in every detail of our lives, that we can see that our life is really the marvel. It's the divine unfolding in the finite. We'll continue on December 5th.
Thank you very much. அனைத்து அன்பர்களுக்கும் நன்றி கூறி வணக்கம் கூறி விடைபெறுகிறோம்.